So it's a great pleasure to be here. This is somewhat out of my usual line of thinking. So I am hoping to get interesting comments and vicious criticism. Okay. So the most important thing to say about this work is that it was done with a large number of outstanding collaborators. Actually, the second important thing to say about this work is, where is the pointer? Does this actually point? Here it is. All right. Yes, there we go. Excellent. All right, yes, you see why I'm not an experimentalist. The two most important questions in experimental physics where I failed at the beginning were, is it plugged in and is it turned on? All right, anyway, this work is done with some outstanding collaborators. I particularly want to highlight Louis-François Arsenault, who is not one of the world's great photographers, but is an outstanding scientist and is in the audience here. Our interest in machine learning actually got stimulated by Anatole von Lilienfeld when he was at Argonne. He's since moved to become a professor of chemistry at Basel. And the most recent stuff, which I'll get to at the end of the talk, has been done in collaboration with Lauren Hanna, who's in the, an assistant professor in the Columbia Physics Department, and Richard Newberg, who is an outstanding graduate student who is just finishing there. Okay, so you guys all know this, but machine learning is a way to find out, essentially by intelligent interpolation, a relationship between an input, which is specified by some number of descriptors, which we'll denote by D, and some kind of output which you're interested in. And the idea is that if you have a database of input descriptors, D sub L, L for learning, for which you know the outputs, then machine learning gives you an intelligent interpolation, which allows you to find the output you care about for other inputs, which are not too far from the ones that you started. Okay, so that's very general. Now, I'm a theoretical physicist, a condensed matter physicist. I'm mostly interested in the quantum mechanics of interacting electrons in solids. And so there's a natural question here, which is, why bother with machine learning at all? All right? And the basic idea, which cuts both ways, is that actually solving a quantum many-body problem is a task which ranges from expensive to impossible. Right? And therefore, if there's anything you can do to leverage the corpus of existing solutions that you have, you should try to do it. Even if the solution you get isn't exact, but is only approximate in some way, the basic problem of getting new solutions is so expensive that leveraging the results is useful. Right? So this can be good for several reasons. One is, as an initial guess, for a more sophisticated approach that you might later optimize. A second reason why you might want an approximate solution is there are many cases, just one second, or were you asking a question or just, okay. There are many cases where you might want to scan a wide range of parameters for of model parameters for interesting behavior. So it's very useful to have something which will give you a rough cut at a solution and at least identify for you areas where you should look in more detail. All right? Here's a very specific case. In many cases, you need, and I shouldn't have written the word small here, you need extrapolations from known solutions. This little figure is an example of work we did on a particular material, neodymium nickel oxide, which has a structural distortion. Right? So it has a high temperature phase in which the structure is symmetric and more or less cubic, described by a particular combination of bond lengths, delta A is zero. You lower the temperature and experimentally it goes into a distorted structure, described by a bond disproportionation, which is not zero. So to understand under what circumstances this happens, what you need to do as a matter of fundamental principle is to compute the energy for a whole bunch of different structures and see which one is lowest. right? Now, in the grand scheme of things, these are not big changes in the material. I have the same basic crystal structure, and I'm moving bonds, moving atoms by 5-10% of their distance. So if there was a way to avoid just doing an expensive ab initio calculation for each one of these points, it would be very good. Okay, now there's another motivation for doing this, which I'm just going to throw out there because, in fact, I don't really have a very good idea how to proceed, but I have this loose idea that there should be a way. You all know that quantum mechanics is, in general, exponentially hard to solve a, to get a generic state, to get a generic solution of a quantum mechanical problem is a computational task which is exponentially large in the number of single particle states you have. The parameter space of situations is also often very large, right? So you have a sort of gigantic wilderness of quantum phase space that you would like to explore. Now, one of the things that the whole world of big data and Google searches and so forth has taught us is that while in many interesting cases you have data which live in a very high dimensional space, which are described by a very large number of different degrees of freedom in principle, in practice, the phenomena you care about are controlled by some kind of very parametrically low dimensional subspace of this high dimensional data space in, that exists in principle. And a virtue of machine learning in the search context is that it's an unbiased way of finding that low dimensional subspace in the parameter space that you care about. So the question, for which I admit I have no concrete ideas, is can big data methods give us a path through this, what I might poetically call a wilderness of computational complexity, to let you find out the parts of the exponentially big many-body problem that you really should care about? All right. So that's the general introduction. The practical question, if you want to do quantum many-body phenomena, is, how do you set up the problem? What's the right set of input descriptors that you want to hear about? What's the right way to represent the output? And the big question, in my mind, is how big a training set do you really need? As I said, solving quantum many-body problems is exponentially hard, right? And that cuts both ways. On the one hand, you want to use whatever methods you have to leverage the solutions you have. On the other hand, to apply machine learning, you have to have enough of a database to get started. And in my mind, it is still an open question in this field whether the database of exact solutions that you need is large enough that you won't be able to construct it in finite time and you should just solve all the problems directly anyway. Okay, so to continue with the introduction, here is a sort of very, very high level summary of a quantum many-body problem. What you do is you take a bunch of atoms, as Kieran explained, and you put them down in some configuration, and then you want to know what the electrons do. Right? And there's various versions of what do the electrons do. You might want to know the ground state energy corresponding to a particular configuration. You might want to know the excitation spectrum. You might want to know, well, anyway, those are the two basic questions. So here's an example. This is a molecule which is of interest to chemists. It's a so-called spin crossover molecule. The part which is relevant is the iron atom here. And then there's all this stuff of other atoms. All right. So the relevant thing is the iron atom, and it's relevant because the iron atom happens to carry a spin. Its D shell is partly filled, and the electrons in the D shell line up, and it may or may not have a spin. All right? So what this molecule does, and it's an example of a large class of molecules with this general property, is that it has two states. At high temperatures, for this molecule above about 200 degrees, the iron has a magnetic moment. What's plotted here is temperature times the magnetic susceptibility. And if you have a free magnetic moment, then the magnetic susceptibility is 1 over temperature. So you multiply by temperature, you get a straight line. The value of the straight line says the moment is 3 Bohr magnetons. Right? And then at some temperature, the spin turns off and goes away. So this is called a spin crossover molecule. You might better say spin transition. It has a high spin and a low spin state. It switches between them. All right. And this kind of behavior is good for various applications, and one would like to understand it better. So the quantum mechanical question is to understand the behavior of the iron as a function of temperature and therefore of what all these other things are doing. right? So that's what I just said. Now, in particular, associated with this high spin, low spin transition is a change of structure. Basically, if you just look at the coordination of the iron in the low spin state, the iron is basically equally coordinated with all its nearest neighbor nitrogen. In the high spin state, the coordination changes. So what the atom does, what the electron does, is related in some way to what the structure is doing, and that's what you want to tease out. Now, there are various more and less expensive many-body ways of calculating this, which I've just sketched here. Never mind all of these things. The basic point is that what you want to see is the energy as a function of this mean nitrogen to iron distance. So this is an example of the kind of thing where one is doing a large number of calculations which boil down to trivial variations of a structure you have. And the hope would be that machine learning can provide a systematic way to leverage a smaller number of calculations and let you really see what's going on there. All right. So here's another example, which is basically the same story, but now in the context of solids. I assume everybody in this audience has heard that there is this class of materials called high transition temperature copper oxide superconductors. They come from crystals which have quite complicated structures. Here's one of the simpler ones that I sketched. There's a subset of the states which are relevant. They're the ones that live in these so-called copper oxygen planes, which I've highlighted here. They're described by some sort of minimal theoretical description, which I don't want to get into here. The details of this minimal description depend on the atomic structure, right? And the details of this minimal theoretical description clearly control things like whether the superconducting transition temperature is 20 Kelvin or 100 Kelvin or 160 Kelvin. So you would like to know an electronic property, let's say, is the darn thing superconducting and at what temperature, as a function of changing all these properties in various small ways. All right? So again, there's an opportunity here for inference from a database. So these are two of a broad class of examples where you would like to be able to generate a database of solved examples of quantum many-body problems and then infer interesting properties from them. All right, so now let me try to convert that into a formal statement, all right? So the way we think about quantum many-body physics is as follows. The input for a general problem is what we call in the jargon of the field the non-interacting Green's function, G sub zero, which describes electron propagation in some kind of reference environment where electron-electron interactions are neglected. So this is the thing that contains information about where the atoms are and quite possibly what electronic degrees of freedom that are in filled shells and you don't care about are doing, right? And then the other part of the input is the interactions amongst these electrons, which is in general some complicated four-index tensor, and I'm just going to call it U, right? The output is the object which gives you the physical electron propagation in the actual system. That's called G. An equivalent description is in terms of something called the self-energy, which is a function which basically parameterizes the difference between the exact electron propagation and the propagation you get in your reference structure, right? So the quantum many-body problem is determining a relationship between G naught and this thing G, right? You can cast this as extremizing a functional, and the functional, closely related to what Kiran Burke said earlier this morning, is a sum of two parts, and I've written this in a very formal way. One part just gives you, encodes the positions of the atoms and all that other stuff. The other part encodes what the interactions are doing. This is something which is determined in a formal way solely by what interactions you have. And demanding that this function is stationary provides a relation between the thing you're interested in, the output, and the inputs, right? So solving a many-body problem, therefore, means you need to learn this functional relationship, which relates this input function to that output function. All right, so if you want to do that, all right, you need to do a couple of different things. You need to have a way to represent the functions. You need to decide what is a good descriptor for the set of functions that you're talking about. Also, and I'll get back to this later, the functions that we're interested in have constraints on them. I'll explain a little bit about the constraints later, but there are various constraints, and you need to impose those constraints to get a physically meaningful solution. So we need to represent functions, we need to impose constraints, and given that, we need to know, basically, can we design a structure based on machine learning that actually works? All right, and once we have it, there's another interesting question that we would like to address, which I would call back inference. Right? I posed the problem to start with as just finding a functional relationship between the input descriptors and the output function. Right? But once you have that, you can ask, if there's a particular property or properties that I want, a transition temperature higher than 100 degrees, a gap to optical absorption which is in the range of 1.5 to 1.8 eV, can I design a G naught, which will give me a G, which has the behavior I want? So these are a very general class of questions. After a brief mathematical digression, I want to show you the first small steps we've taken down the road to seeing if you can actually do this. All right. So the digression, an important constraint is as follows. The Green's function depends on a frequency or energy variable. The general structure of many-body physics says that this object is analytic in the complex frequency plane, which I've sketched here, except for a branch cut discontinuity across the real axis, which I've tried to sketch by this red thing. So you can define the spectral function, which is the size of the branch cut discontinuity. And this function, which has the physical meaning of a density of states, in other words, a probability of adding or removing an electron at that frequency, obeys some constraints. In particular, it's non-negative because it's the probability of adding or removing an electron. It integrates to pi in the conventions that I've drawn here, and it typically has compact support or at least decays very rapidly at infinity. Right? So these are constraints that have to be included. Now, a bit of jargon. There is a general theory of complex variables which says if I have a function which is analytic in the upper and lower half plane, just has a branch cut, the branch cut has compact support and is integrable, then I can write the function anywhere in the complex plane by this Kramers-Kronig integral. And in fact, there are technical reasons, which I'm not going to tell you in quantum many-body physics, for why it's particularly easy to evaluate this function on the imaginary frequency axis at a discrete set of points which are related to the physical temperature. Right? And there's a general theorem of complex variables which says that if I know this guy at this discrete infinity of points, then I can reconstruct the exact function and in particular can reconstruct the branch cut. Okay, so much for formalism. Now I'm going to show you a bit about what we actually did. As the late unlamented Chairman Mao said, a journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. And the single step that we took here is a very, very crude toy model of this spin crossover system, which is so crude that it doesn't even really have spin crossover in it. I'm just going to approximate this iron as a level that can hold 0, 1, or 2 electrons. This level is at some energy relative to the background states in the solid, which is the rest of this. And there's some interaction which basically disfavors if it's positive or favors which if it's negative configurations when there's two electrons on the site. Right? So this is the world's simplest many-body problem. It's a single interacting site coupled to a non-interacting bath. Right? There's a lot known about this. In particular, if you take my friend the spectral function here, if you turn off interactions, then of course it has a shape which is determined by the hybridization of your local level, whose energy is here, to all the other states. If you take one particular choice of states, which was made in this paper for reasons I don't want to go into, you get this sort of quasi-Lorentzian peak here. Now, as you turn on the interaction, the structure changes. Ignore the dotted lines, which are a wrong approximation. What you see is sidebands, which are split by this energy U. Basically, you can remove an electron from here, but then if you add it, it costs an energy up here. And the non-trivial feature, this central peak. All right, so that's a behavior which is a consequence of many-body physics, the sidebands and the central peak, and which you would like to be able to calculate. Now, the inputs in this thing are the rest of this huge hairy molecule, the bath of non-interacting states, which is characterized by some kind of density of states. This is the only combination of these things that you really need to know. The details of this are understood not to be important, so we just chose a semicircle density of states hybridized to the electrons by some parameter V. The other inputs are the energy of the D level, which is more or less the same thing as its occupancy, and the strength of the interaction. So we have a very simple set of descriptors, hybridization to the bath, interaction strength, and occupancy. We have the output, which is this Green's function, now just the correlators of this local level. And then we investigated how you can represent this. So there's various ways to represent it, including you can make a Legendre polynomial expansion of this thing. You can represent it as a continued fraction expansion. You can take values at these frequencies. And then we made a kernel ridge regression formalism to get the coefficients of this function in that basis. So we got the object to be learned. We got the descriptor, which I showed you. We got the values of the descriptors describing the learning set. And we have a kernel. And to be honest, I don't understand quite why this is. But for machine learning aficionados, a simple exponential kernel worked best. And the actual distance function you put in between the two descriptors is not so important. We use the Manhattan distance, but there are other ones that you can do. And I'll come back to the width part a bit later. All right. And then the way machine learning works is you have these coefficients, which are fixed by the training set. Right? And to fix this from the training set, basically, you minimize a function, a different one for each component. The minima are a different one for each component. And the function you minimize is essentially the difference between the exact value and the value your machine predicts. And then you need this hyperparameter to avoid overfitting data. All right, so you follow the procedure, and you get some answers, which I'm showing you here. This is essentially in units where of percents of essentially just the mean deviation between the prediction and the exact result, which we know because this is a trivial model, for the various different representations of the function on a log scale. And the main thing you see is that it works reasonably well, but to get errors on the order of a percent, which is here, you need rather long learning sets. You can then go on and ask, what does the actual Green's function look like? Again, you see deviations in the interesting region for short learning sets. As you go to larger learning sets, it becomes exact. You can then reconstruct the actual density of states. And you see basically the same set of behaviors. And finally, and I forgot to highlight this actually back on my previous slide. I'm sorry to flash this in front of you. A characteristic of this peak is its relative area compared to the one in the non-interacting state. If you like, part of the physics of this model is that at low temperatures, it has a low energy spectrum, which has qualitatively the same properties as the non-interacting model. And there's a difference, which in the jargon of the field is called Z, which is the relative weight of the actual peak in the interacting model compared to what you had in the non-interacting model. So that's an important thing of physical interest. You can extract it from the Green's functions we got. And again, you can see for different methods how well it agrees. All right. So what we learned by doing this toy model is that first, this procedure does work on some level. Second, in terms of representing functions on this imaginary frequency or imaginary time axis, as it turns out, the representation in terms of Legendre polynomials is preferred because it gives you the most compact representation. You need the fewest basis functions to represent your function. And finally, the required data set is not small. OK. So that's step one. Now I'd like to go on from there to see if we can learn a lattice many-body problem. So this, which is called the Hubbard model in the trade, is perhaps the simplest lattice many-body model. So it's the same thing we had before, except now every site is interacting. There's a thing which disfavors double occupancy if it's positive on each site of my molecule. And this lets electrons hop around from site to site. Okay. So the Anderson model we did before is essentially this model with only one interacting site. Right? Now, this model is known to have two phases. One, an insulator, if the density is one per site and U is large, and otherwise a metallic phase if the density is different from one or U is not large. Right? This model can be solved by a particular approximation I don't have time to go into. And we're going to see if we can learn that solution. So now the descriptors are basically what you do with this density of states. By changing these hoppings, you can change the non-interacting density of states over a wide range. These are some examples. Then you have the interaction and the electron density. The output is a phase, metal or insulator, and the Green's function. Right. Now, one thing we did here, that by the way, I mean Louis-Francois, is a cross-validation step which essentially optimizes the width parameter in our kernel ridge regression. Right? So we choose this by cross-validation in this way. Right? And what you see is that that allows you to get respectable results with much smaller databases, now of the order of a few hundred. This number here was more like 5 in our previous case. And by the time you have learning sets now of the order of a bit more than 1,000, you get essentially perfect agreement. So now to do this, what we have to do is two steps. First, we have to classify this. We have to do a classification step to say, does our given set of inputs correspond to an insulator or a metal? And then once we have it, we then learn the output. The classification, again, because I'm running out of time, I will just throw up some jargon and say that it works essentially perfectly. Then with at least these moderate to large databases, you could learn the answers essentially exactly. In each of these cases, the open circles is machine learning. The dots are what we know from an a priori exact solution. Right? And finally, you can use this to reverse engineer things. You can ask, what values of this and this, for example, should I put in to get a desired many-body density of states? Right. So this is a particular example where we just take a small database of insulating examples and we say we want to tune the density of states to get a gap which is 2 electron volts. All right. So to summarize, this combination of cross... Wait, I'm sorry, I'm now lost. You right. So I'm sorry, so where am I now? You're telling me I should stop or... Oh, okay, great. Okay, sorry. So to summarize this portion of the talk, what we see is, at least within this particular representation of many-body physics, first, the combination of cross-validation and intelligent representation of functions using a minimal basis allows us to learn many-body problems with learning set sizes which are not insane to get respectable errors, right? And once you've done this, then you can reverse engineer and ask, if I have a given physical property, how should I tune my model parameters to get it, right? So the open question, which is the next step in our research program and is not done yet, is can we now extend this to more realistic situations with a richer structure of interactions and a richer structure, let's say, of inputs that has some realism of atoms? So that's an open question, and I would say stay tuned. In the remaining time, I want to go back and talk a little bit about the constrained functions in a particular context. Right? So I told you before that the functions that we're interested in are analytic in the upper and lower half planes and are characterized by a branch cut with a discontinuity which has unit area and non-negative, and is non-negative. I also said that mathematics essentially tells us that in this situation, if we know this function on a discrete infinity of points in the complex plane with a reasonable limit at infinity, then in principle, you can reconstruct this guy. All right, that's analytic continuation. Now, principles are one thing, and practice is another. To actually do this reconstruction, you have to invert essentially this operator. Right? I'm saying we know this, you want to get this, so you're inverting the integral operator. And the problem is that operators of this kind have an enormous number of very small eigenvalues. And that means that the inverse of the operator has an enormous number of very large eigenvalues. Now, in physical problems, if you knew the input data exactly, the large eigenvalues wouldn't bother you. But as soon as you have tiny errors in your input data, they can couple to the large eigenvalues, and therefore propagate to big errors in the inferred A. So this is a classic ill-posed problem, right? And it has a standard solution, which is the so-called maximum entropy method, which is what everybody uses, where in essence you minimize a function that looks like this. So there's an energy part, which is essentially the difference between what you predict and your data, and an entropy part whose job is to smooth things out and prevent you from overfitting. Now, the thing about maximum entropy is that it's a black box which works in mysterious ways. You need to guess a model function here, you need to guess a parameter alpha, and it has a priori with it no method for assessing errors. Right? So what we wanted to know was, can you do better by statistical inference? Right? In other words, can we view this not as an inversion problem, but as an inference problem? Right? And it's promising because the forward problem, calculating your G given A, is computationally free. So in this problem, we can get as big a database as you want with no effort. All right? The second key point is that viewing this as statistical inference, in other words, regression on your data, gives you a natural way to regularize the problem, by which I mean removing, in effect, the small eigenvalues of A or the large K or the large eigenvalues of K inverse. All right? And finally, and this is a technical point that I will talk about, in fact, regression methods and what statisticians have done gives you a nice way of dealing with constraints. And probably the most important thing is that once you're doing statistical regression, you have error estimates available. Okay, so as a minor technical point, we, by which I mean Richard and Louis-Francois, found that the best way to represent the function that we want to learn, in fact, is by its coefficients in the following conformal expansion. This is just some energy scale which is reasonably representative of the size of the problem. It doesn't really matter what you take. Anyway, so you can represent the function like this, and it's good to represent it in using these coefficients. Okay, so then we can make a learning set which has many examples. Here's two. Because this is free, we in fact made a learning set of size 10,000. There's a couple of different tuning sets. You could make this much bigger and it wouldn't really bother you. We note that our learning is going to involve directly comparing a function of real frequencies to another function of real frequencies. So you don't need to get involved in the complex plane at all. Another point, of course, when we generate our data, these are exact because they're numerically generated. We want to use this for approximate data. So we take our tuning and test sets, which are here, and we corrupt them by adding noise of various magnitudes to see what happens. We need two tuning sets, basically one to tune the hyperparameters like the width. So here's an example. This is what I showed you before. This is the Lagrange multiplier part that I didn't adequately explain. This is the width in our Manhattan distance. Here we have our training set, and we choose our hyperparameters for each different value of the random noise. That's these three sheets to minimize the minimum average error in our training set. And it depends on the noise, how you tune it. We also use a second training set to tune the covariance matrix, which is useful for projection and error estimates. Now, projection is an important part. We want to get out of this process functions that are non-negative, have unit area, and indeed have various other known moments. So there are several constraints. You could just imagine doing a constrained regression problem, but this is computationally expensive and unstable. Right? And what we find is that the good thing to do is do an unconstrained regression, which will give you an answer which doesn't necessarily satisfy your constraints, but if you're doing reasonably well, it gets you close. And then we project back into the space that satisfies the constraints. We find the one which is closest to what we got by the unconstrained regression. So basically, we minimize a simple quadratic function. Right? Now, of course, so we minimize a quadratic function with the constraints imposed by Lagrange multipliers, so that's just a linear programming problem. The one wrinkle is that, of course, when you do this fitting, there are some parts of your data set which are frequencies which are well learned and some parts which are not so well learned. So when you compute the distance, you project back to the closest guy in the space that satisfies the constraints to the thing that your regression problem gave you. Basically, you want to define closest in terms of the covariance matrix. And indeed, You don't want the whole covariance matrix because it's full of all kinds of small things with noise, so you do a principal component analysis and take a modest number of principal components. Okay. Once you have the covariance matrix, then of course you can also get error estimates. This is a particular example where we did an analytical continuation, and then the so the red is what our machine gave us, the black is the exact one, and the shaded area indicates the 90% confidence limits. Right? You can do error analysis. There are two metrics that we considered, which have fancy names, which come from statisticians. This is essentially the error metric that maximum entropy optimizes. It's called the Kubik-Leibler error metric in statistics, and the other is the one I showed you. It's just the standard difference. And now we can compare what we do to maximum entropy for our data set. In pictures like this, basically, blue lines are ones where our blue points are the ones where maximum entropy is giving you a smaller difference to the actual function. Red is the ones where our method gives you a smaller distance to the actual function, and these are the two different error methods. This is for a modest level of noise, about 10 to the minus a tenth of a percent uncertainty, and you can see that in general our method does much better. Yeah. That's a typo. Sorry, excuse me. Kolbeck. It's excuse me. yeah. All right. So, and as you get to more and more accurate data, smaller noise, particularly for the, I think there it's spelled correctly. As you get to very tiny noise, maximum entropy gets competitive. In fact, if you count up the number of points, basically they're the same here and here. If you use this error metric, which is not the one maximum entropy is optimized for, our method is still better. So to summarize this coda to the talk, basically, I think statistical inference is a good way of solving these ill-posed inverse problems. The method gives you essentially a straightforward way to regularize the ill-posed operator that you want to invert. And it provides an error estimate, which is independent of the particular solution, right? And finally, I would say that this is the result of a few months' work, and it's produced already a method which is comparable to maximum entropy, which has been optimized for a couple of decades. And finally, the method could be useful for other inverse problems. And we will have to feed this back into what we did for many body physics, where the Green's functions we're trying to learn obey constraints, and where you want this real axis information, which you have to get by doing this kind of inverse problem. So with that, I will stop and thank you for your attention.
So in the comparison to the Hubbard model, was that a one-dimensional Hubbard model?
No.
That was just,
No, but it was the dynamical mean field solution. So there's a sense in which it was an infinite dimensional.
I understand, right. So one thing this fascinating talk brings up is the possibility of combining this with quantum simulators to say, oh, well, let's try, suppose we have a small quantum simulator and we can actually generate some data from this for some system where we don't know how to calculate what the exact model is. And then, you know, we have a bunch of data from the system. We're trying to optimize our quantum simulator. Can you comment on how that would be? It seems to me it would be quite close that you to kind of take out the kind of classical computational guts of the problem to generate instances, and you just put in a quantum simulator to generate instances.
So I think this is a very rich question. And I think there's a lot of different directions here, some of which are related to machine learning and some of which are related to general questions of many-body physics. I think the first statement is that I'm sure there is a lot of ground to be gained by, let's say, intelligently using quantum simulators at appropriately chosen points in a many-body calculation. There have been a few papers I've been partly involved with, one on this, and I think there's a lot more to be done, and that's a very powerful strategy. Now, to come back to the machine learning context, I think that both for using quantum simulators and more generally for using any simulator, what you're really saying is, look, we can't do the general quantum many-body problem. It's exponentially expensive. But there's a lot of simpler things we can do, solving small systems, for example, solving things approximately at high temperature. There's a whole bunch of approximate calculations that one can do at a feasible computational cost. And I understood your question as asking, can we somehow use these extrapolation ideas to leverage those solutions and guess something about the solution to the full problem? I think that's an extremely interesting idea, and it's one that we haven't considered at all, so I have nothing useful to say about it, but it's obviously worth exploring.
You had a specific form for the representation of the Green's function before you did the machine learning.
Right.
Can you comment on how the answers would change depending on that form?
Yes. And this is discussed sort of, I'm sorry I went over that too quickly. This is discussed ad nauseum in this paper. So here are a couple of examples. These are four different ways of representing the function. And these are the errors you get applying, you know, exactly the same procedure, just with these different representations. You see that, I should say, we have analogous pictures to these for different representations. This is an example where, in fact, a particular example where the renormalization factor you might be interested in is given spectacularly badly by the continued fraction approach, and all the other guys are close. But I think that the general take-home message is that the important feature of the representation is that you want it to be as compact as possible, right? Because you're trying to learn a function, and a function is specified by some number n of parameters, which are its expansion in some basis. And you want to keep that number of basis functions as small as possible to minimize the errors in learning. And it appears that the continued fraction, I'm sorry, the Legendre polynomial expansion, which was introduced into our world by Olivier Parcollet and his collaborators a couple of years ago, is substantially the most compact. And for that reason, and also it builds in some of the constraints, in particular the high frequency asymptotic behavior. So that's preferred. But it really comes back down to compactness of representation.
Do people know why it's better?
Oh, I think it's why it's more compact, I think, is the question.
Yeah.
This is essentially applied math. It's the functions that you want to represent, if you think of them as functions in imaginary time, are characterized by an anti-periodicity property, an endpoint magnitude and derivative discontinuity, which are easy to implement in this Legendre polynomial thing, because they're just functions which are defined on the interval 0 to 1 with particular behaviors at the end. So Legendre polynomials do a good job of parametrizing those endpoint singularities. I think that's really why it comes out to be more compact. And it's one of these things, once Olivier said Legendre polynomials, it was like completely obvious that you should do that. And for 15 years in the field, we've been wandering around not doing it, and nobody can understand why after Olivier said that.